This is Donette Thayer of Game Theory, and you're listening to 90.7 FM WGXC, ICRA.
Hay acciones cotidianas para ayudar a prevenir la propagación de enfermedades respiratorias. Lávese las manos. Evite el contacto cercano con las personas enfermas. Evite tocarse los ojos, la nariz y la boca. Quédese en casa cuando esté enfermo. Cúbrase al toser o estornudar. Limpie y desinfecte de manera frecuente los objetos que toca. Para obtener más información, visite cdc.gov/COVID-19. Este mensaje es gentileza de la National Association of Broadcasters y de esta estación.
WGXC underwriting support is provided by Gemini Construction, a full-service contracting firm specializing in complete electrical construction services. Gemini Construction, serving Greene and surrounding counties for over 40 years. For more information, contact 518-622-9829.
WGXC is made possible in part by the generous ongoing support of Shannon Greer Photography in Brooklyn, New York. Sustaining supporters are among the station's most dedicated listeners. They care deeply about Creative Community Radio, and their investment helps to sustain WGXC as a public platform for information, experimentation, and engagement in Greene and Columbia counties. You too can become a WGXC sustaining supporter by investing in community radio every month. Go to wgxc.org and click donate. Thank you for your support.
Let's begin.
You have 5 seconds. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Don't worry if you can't follow everything that is said.
Now repeat.
Thank you.
Hello and welcome back. You're listening to a myriad of musings and music on WGXC. Up next, we have a song by Hootie and the Blowfish called A Smile. Interviewing Charles Cross, an advanced EMT and BLS crew chief for Charleston County EMS. Charles, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
So the first question is, could you just tell us a little bit about yourself and what you do?
Sure. Again, my name's Charlie Cross. I'm from Washington, D.C. originally. I went to Salisbury High School up in Connecticut after going to middle school in D.C., and it's how I got to know Nora and her mom, Jen, and then came down here to College of Charleston as a public health major and just graduated last December. In the middle of my freshman, sophomore year of college, I got my EMT certification and have had it for about now coming on 4 years. With that certification. I've been 3 years now, I've been working with Charleston County EMS. And then while it was actually at Call to Charleston, I was the director of Call to Charleston EMS for about 2 years, and I'll still help out with them ever so often. But that's a little bit about me. Yeah, I've been doing EMS for about 4 years now, and then probably in the next year or so looking to do military stuff.
Great. So we can hear some birds in the background and a little bit of that. So could you about where you are? I mean, just...
Oh, yeah, I'm just outside my apartment. I'm enjoying my day off. We've been working a lot of days, and I just want to come outside. So that's, if you hear something, it's probably that.
Was there a specific moment, event, or person that led you to become an EMT?
Not specifically. Growing up in D.C., I grew up in a military household, and grew up around... I mean, if you live in D.C. for any period of time, you're used to lights and sirens kind of going everywhere. So I was immediately attracted to that. Kind of just going fast and type of aspect. Uh-huh. And I really enjoyed medicine. I got my like first aid certification when I was 12 and thought it was something interesting. And the opportunity to get it came available to me in between my freshman and sophomore year at College of Charleston. So I kind of jumped on it, just kind of rode with it. And here I am now. So I wouldn't say there's a specific like moment. A lot of like our EMTs that you work with have like a bad experience, not a bad experience, but some type of experience where they came across like a cardiac arrest or some friend having an allergic reaction or something like that, and like, oh, in that moment I wanted to be an EMT. I don't really have a moment like that, but just an opportunity arose and I kind of hopped on it and I haven't looked back since.
Okay, so what advice would you give to someone wanting to become an EMT, like a young person or someone
Absolutely.
Who's just found out about
it? I think
it.
It's being an EMT they're great life skills. You'll never know when you're in a situation that warrants you maybe having to use those skills. As far as becoming an EMT, the certification process is, it's about a semester long, depending on how you did it or how you do it. But just stick with it, study your materials. It all makes more sense at the end of the class. You learn so many acronyms, so many different systems and, a lot of different elements of the body, kind of the life-saving components that you might be overwhelmed with at first. But towards the end of the class, it all starts making sense. But I would not, if anyone is interested in going to EMT school, my another piece of advice is don't limit yourself just to EMS. Use this as a stepping stone to further, if you're going down the route, a career in the medical field. So don't limit yourself just to EMS and getting your EMT. Move on to things like getting your, if you want to be a RN or even eventually med school or any other type of kind of healthcare field, if you want to go to administration, getting your EMT is an awesome starting point. But don't limit yourself just to your EMT. Always keep pushing forward and trying to expand your certification horizon.
So I guess going off that last question, is there anything that you wish you would have known, I guess, before you came an EMT that would have made it?
I think there's a lot of the stuff you see on TV and a lot of the stuff that, I mean, you just have this mindset in your head that EMS is all 100% like, I don't know how to describe it, but go, 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 life-saving, like you're saving people every single day. And reality, I think 80% of what we do is very not intense, but you're not putting tourniquets and saving lives every single day. There's a lot of mundane stuff, transfers and different medical calls where they might need an ambulance, but they don't need it emergently. That's the majority of what the work we do in EMS is. Not to say that we're not making a difference, but it's not the kind of the life-saving stuff you see on the TV. Now there is definitely a portion, right. I'd say it's about 20% of what we do is that emergent stuff where we're doing critical life-saving interventions, but I'd say the other 80% is going to be kind of the rest of your day-to-day kind of psychiatric care, your sick persons, and kind of jumping off of that. When you call 911 and you get an ambulance, you have to understand that we go through these situations on a daily basis. We see these car accidents, you have the elderly falling. And for us, these are pretty stuff we do every day, but to the lay person, it's a lot of chaos. It's a lot of, you don't know what to do. So by calling 911, you're bringing kind of calmness to the storm, so to speak. We kind of control the chaos and just kind of work through the progress. So when someone kind of feels helpless in a way because they don't know what to do, it's usually when they call 911. And it's kind of where we, that's kind of some of the work we do. It sounds very cliche, but we do wear a lot of hats. We have to deal with a lot of different situations, from psychiatric care to pediatrics, to almost social work sometimes. So there's a lot going on that we try to fix and try to help out with on a day-to-day basis.
Yeah. So, you did talk about, calling 911, but can you describe sort of basic, what your day entails? And you wake up in the morning and then you go to work.
Yeah, sure. Absolutely. Were you speaking like specific? So right now, I'm full-time with Charleston County EMS. So we work every other weekend, Saturday, Sunday, Monday. So I'll work Saturday, Sunday, Monday. I'll have Tuesday, Wednesday off. I work Thursday, Friday, and I'll have that weekend off, and the whole system resets itself. I work 12-hour shifts. The majority of us work 12-hour shifts. I'm from 8 to 8. So we start our day in our logistics public works department up in North Charleston. We go get our truck. We make sure we have all the equipment on it that we need. We do our checkoffs, just kind of get all your personal equipment in the ambulance, and then you go available. The BLS truck that I'm on, we are available for BLS calls. So your traumatic. So when I say BLS and I say ALS, think ALS is advanced life support, and BLS is basic life support. So ALS is your cardiac arrest, your chest pains, your breathing problems, your severe traumatic injuries, among other things. And think BLS as general feeling unwell, someone with maybe like flu-like symptoms that doesn't have any type of respiratory compromise. Those are like breathing problems, and small kind of traumatic injuries. So let's say a laceration to the arm or pain that doesn't kind of show a traumatic injury. So a lot of our traffic accidents, like I have arm pain, but their arms looks okay. That's the kind of accident. Those are the kind of calls that we take. So we go as a BLS unit to the traffic accidents, the traumatic injuries, the sick people that don't warrant an ALS ambulance. So it's a lot of kind of rudimentary stuff that we do, but it's awesome because it gives our more junior personnel like myself the ability to run our own truck and make our own decisions on scene without kind of reporting back to a more seasoned paramedic. But then when you work an ALS truck, you're going to those ALS calls, breathing problems and severe car accidents, or just kind of more of those in-depth calls that need a little bit more intervention. So they'll send a paramedic unit too. But in Charleston County, we run about 10 to 15 calls a day, depending on where you go. If you stay in the central location, you're going to stay busy. But if you go into an outlying station, you might only run 3 or 5. But as the population in Charleston gets bigger, our call volume has been increasing. So we're starting to see more calls each day.
So out of your, I guess, whole, not necessarily chaotic day, but long, sometimes hard days, what was your favorite part of your day? Whether it be saving someone's life or going
to I really enjoy what we do. I really enjoy running calls. I'm one of the ones that really likes to stay busy. That's why I'm working the BLS truck, because it's normally a really busy truck. So for me, it's interacting with patients. I also really enjoy the people that we work with. You are your partner for that day. You're with them for 12 hours, and you really are kind of relying on them. So you got to spend a lot of time with them. So I enjoy being around the people I work with. It's a great team. It's a great support network. So I think the favorite part of my day is kind of spending your day with your partner, seeing other people on the street. Then, of course, I enjoy just running calls because everything's different. Every call's different. You never know what you're going to get. So there's that you're kind of feeling of going into the unknown where you get on every call. But it's, I think running calls for me is probably my favorite part of my day.
So going back a little bit, could you just describe some of the training you have gone through?
Yeah, sure.
I mean, what that was like.
So there's 3 different certifications in EMS. Actually, there's 4. You have your emergency medical responder, which is really, really basic skills. It's one of a lot of lifeguards have, along with the lifeguard certification. And then you have your EMT, which is about 120 hours, I want to say, of classroom skills. So you're usually, for your EMT, you're looking at about a semester long class that you take maybe twice a week. And those are filled with a lot of classroom skills, a lot of scenarios. You're really practicing those skills. You do some ride time on the ambulances as a third person. So you get to practice those skills on actual patients, which is awesome. It's a really great part of the training. For my advanced EMT certification, I was another couple hundred hours and a little bit more ride time. And then the next jump up from that is your paramedic, which is in some places actually an associate's degree. It could take you 2 years to complete. There's some programs where you can do it in a year. But it requires a lot more knowledge, a lot more practice with patients, and is kind of the top of the certification level for EMS. You can get into the nitty-gritty other mini certifications that go along with your paramedic. But for me, it was probably at least 300 hours of training to get to the advanced level that I'm, the advanced EMT level that I'm at now.
So you talked before about your favorite part of the job, but on the other side, what is the part that you find most difficult or the hardest part for you?
Oh, that's a really good question. I think for me, I really don't have a bad part of my day. I mean, when you get to the most difficult part, I mean, we do have the, I think it's the fortunate, but yet unfortunate side of EMS is we see ourselves in some pretty weird situations, where you're dealing with death, you're dealing with trauma, you're dealing with kind of things you just don't normally, the average person usually doesn't see. I kind of call it the underbelly that the news doesn't really see, that that a lot of people don't know about, that what we go to, which can kind of leave a lasting effect on you. I really have had the pleasure of not having that really have a great effect on me. But we have a really good support network within the system where you can talk to somebody if a call is bothering you. But as far as the more like the, not the best part of the day, I mean, cleaning your truck really usually kind of stinks, but, you got to do it. But, other than that, I think I enjoy most part of our days. There's really nothing I don't look forward to, but when you come across those calls that can kind of get to you, that's kind of one of the things that doesn't really sit well, but you kind of get the help you need and get through it.
So could you just tell us how many apparatus you run in the county of Charleston?
So we are, as Charleston County EMS, we run just ambulances. So in the peak of the day, we might have somewhere to 25 ambulances available, maybe less than that. We don't run fire. So we have a lot of fire departments that we work with in Charleston County. We have City of Charleston, we have North Charleston, West Ashley, James Island, St. John's, St. Mount Pleasant, Allendale, St. Paul's, Isle of Palm, Sullivan's Island, plenty of fire departments that we run with. So they handle more of the fire calls, the high angle rescues, the water rescues and whatnot. We just provide the medical assistance, to those calls. But they take care of the more the kind of the apparatus needs, like ladder trucks and rescue trucks and stuff like that.
So in your capacity as a BLS crew chief, what does your day look like as the crew chief as different as someone on the crew?
So I think the more the responsive, I have a really, really good partner at work. So I don't really have to worry about kind of wondering where my partner is or wondering what he's doing, because it's your responsibility as being in charge of the truck to make sure you're responsible with your partner. But I have full faith in the guy that I work with and trust him with pretty much everything. So I don't really have to worry about being on top of your partner. But when it comes to the crew chief role, you're at the end of the day, you're the one that gets in trouble. And you're the one that gets in trouble if something goes wrong. So you're operationally in charge of your ambulance. So making sure you're following policy, making sure you're following procedure, and where you put your ambulance on a call, how many patients, or just just scene management really kind of falls down to the crew chief and making those decisions. One of the big decisions as a crew chief on the BLS truck that we have that you don't really have to deal with on the ALS trucks is identifying patients that might need more care, like an ALS ambulance. So we're making those patient care decisions. But again, my partner, I mean, he's in some opinions, probably better EMT than me some days. We really kind of work together and it flows really, really well. So we kind of share the responsibilities in those situations.
Could you tell us a little bit about the collaboration that you do with any other departments such as fire or police?
Yeah, sure. So if in the Charleston County, for most, if not, I'd say most, more the non-critical calls that we go to, fire department usually doesn't come with us. But on most critical calls, the fire department will respond with us to every single call. So we work really hand in hand with them. We do trainings with them. They're our backup. And they're usually actually getting there first on most calls because we're sometimes spread a little thin. So they might make patient care first or patient contact first, and then we get there as an ambulance. So they're getting working on vitals. They're getting a story. They're getting a history. They're kind of relaying us, giving us that information. So it's a really good relationship we have with our fire departments within Charleston County. But for most calls, we're running with the fire departments right now. Or actually right now during the coronavirus, the fire department, unless it's a critical call, cardiac arrest, choking, severe difficulty breathing, unconscious faintings, they're actually staging, which means they're parking down the street away from the call until EMS makes contact first. So we kind of can reduce the risk that our firefighters are getting exposed to coronavirus unnecessarily. And then for our police departments, again, we have City of Charleston, North Charleston Police, Charleston County Sheriff's Office, and all the Barrier Island Police Department, some Mount Pleasant Police that we work with. So they come and secure our scene, so to speak, when there's a potential for danger on a scene. So we have intoxicated patients with weapons or just kind of unknown situations, the police will go ahead and go in there first and secure the scene before allowing EMS and fire to enter. So it's a really good working relationship we have with all of our fire and police departments.
So isn't you're constantly giving back to the community? Why is giving back to a community important to you as an individual?
It's something I was actually raised with. The community here in Charleston's given me a lot, given me the opportunity to study here. It's an incredible city to recreate in, be on the water. And it's just an opportunity to kind of give back to the city, give back to the county in different ways. So being able to help in any way you can. And I think that goes closer also to the College of Charleston when I was just a volunteer. I get paid at Charleston County to do work. But at College of Charleston, I never got any type of monetary value out of working with College of Charleston EMS. I got a lot of other value out of it, but just no monetary. And I think that goes back to the College of Charleston gave me a lot of opportunity while I was here. And it was just a really cool way to be able to give back to the campus community and whatnot.
So do you have any, I guess, regrets about something that you wish, I don't know, you wish could have happened that didn't happen, or about your experience as an EMT?
I wouldn't say I have any regrets. Kind of boil this down into two parts. So as far as like my time with Charleston County working as an EMT, I don't have any regrets as far as what agency I worked for, what training I got, or anything else like that. When you boil it down to other thing, when you talk about regrets or anything else, when you come to like a call, let's say you ran a call and you're like, maybe I shouldn't have done that, or maybe I should have did this. It's really unhealthy, unfortunately, to keep running through those kind of scenarios in your head. EMS endorses a really big training opportunity. Everything's a training opportunity. You got to be learning something from every single call and able to be successful in EMS. So instead of turning it into kind of regrets, you turn it into a learning opportunity. It's like, hey, maybe next time I'm going to do this. If you grossly do something that you shouldn't have that had an impact on patient care, you bring it to the attention of the right people and you go over it, you discuss it, and you learn from it and you move forward. But mm-hmm. as far as regrets go, it's always a training opportunity and always a way to improve your care and kind of get better down the way.
Could you tell us a little bit about the decon process for your ambulance if you transport a potential coronavirus?
Yeah, absolutely. So regardless of corona patients, we wipe down, we have Clorox wipes. Sometimes we have bleach wipes, but different chemical wipes that we use to wipe down the insides of our ambulance when it's not corona time. We wipe down our stretcher, our monitor, the blood pressure cuff, everything that someone could have came in contact with. When we get into when we have a corona patient, we're obviously protecting ourselves with PPE, but we're spraying our trucks down again with all those chemicals that will clean it for us, make it safe for us. And then we actually have the opportunity, if we believe we had corona is a droplet virus. It's spread through droplets in the air. So our concern there comes when we can, it just makes us contact on other surfaces in the ambulance. If we think we had a patient where they had coronavirus and we were kind of dealing with their airway, like putting different adjuncts in or trying to do our best to ventilate the patient, we can go up to our public works department and we spray them down with a stronger, less, it's not a harsh chemical, but a stronger chemical that can really decontaminate the trucks better than we can with just wipes. So that's a good service that Charleston County gives us in order to have our ambulances clean and ready for the next patient.
So as our final question, this is kind of a little bit silly, but it came up in a discussion. Do you know how to change a tire on an ambulance? And has that ever come in handy?
Actually, it's funny that you asked that. We actually can't change. It's unlike a car. So you guess how many tires an ambulance has?
Six.
Yeah. So in the back there's four, in the front there's two. So if one of those inner tires goes out or it gets flat, it's really, really hard for us to change it on the street. So we are actually contracted with a tire company that will come out to wherever we are and change the tire on the spot and handle all that for us. And it will be ready to roll shortly after that.
Well, we have really enjoyed learning about your experience as an EMT in Charleston, and thank you so much for coming on the show with us today.
No problem, Nora.
We would now like to take a moment to say thank you to all doctors, nurses, EMS personnel, and other healthcare workers. We truly appreciate your humility, kindness, courage, and hard work during this difficult and uncertain period. Your intelligence, bravery, and compassion are the guiding light of our nation through this dark time, and there are no words to adequately thank you.
Smell of wine and cheap perfume.
Up next, we have Brown Eyed Girl by Van Morrison, and then an interview with the Hudson Chief of Police, L. Edward Moore. Now we have our interview with the Hudson Chief of Police, L. Edward Moore.
So today we are going to be, Miles and I are going to be interviewing Chief of Police in Hudson, New York, L. Edward Moore. We've interviewed him one time before on this show. And so our first question is, I know we asked you a little bit about why you became a policeman last time, and you said that no one in your family was specifically in the police department. But is there a person or an event that inspired you to go into this profession?
Yeah, I mean, I said before, my mother's side was immigrant family, and my grandfather was a coal miner. My father was more or less a farmer.
Yeah.
There was no one, to my knowledge, in my family ever in the police work, police line of duty, so... My brother Bobby was a town justice at a young age, and I looked up to him. He was 7 years older than me, and he was always around law enforcement in his capacity as being a judge. So I got exposed to deputies and troopers and other judges, so it was interesting to me. Also had a couple, especially a trooper that I was a member of my church, and I looked up to him. And it was a very good man. So it got me to thinking that, about doing that. But I never, from growing up, never really said, hey, I want to be a cop. It just kind of happened.
So you are now the chief in Hudson. How is this different from being a police officer? And what was the transition like from officer to chief?
Well, I was a state trooper for 32 years. And then an urban police officer here in Hudson. So the two jobs are different. I managed police officers. I managed troopers when I was in the state police. And the management of officers here, that's where there are similarities. Managing people, human resources, working within contracts and within the law and conducting really good investigations. I did have some experience in that, but the nature of policing is different here in an urban environment as opposed to a country or highway patrol.
Mm-hmm. Did you ever expect that you'd become like a police chief of an urban?
I never expected I'd be a police officer. It's just that when I started, I enjoyed it so much. And then the way life is, as we all find out, circumstances happen that are beyond your control. So I got a call from a city alderman that said that they were going to have an opening for a police chief. Mm-hmm. And I was so content in my old job. I've always been lucky and happy in my work. And I had no real thoughts of leaving my old job. But when the alderman contacted me and we talked about this city, which I have a lot of history in this city, I was born here. Mm-hmm. It intrigued me and felt it was time to freshen up and open up some more brain cells. So I took the job and I've been very, very thankful that I did.
Great. So I guess that leads us into our next question. Do you have like a favorite part of working, of being a police chief or more generally working in law enforcement?
Yeah, I like, you see, I think people's perceptions of police are different than what I have from the inside. Mm-hmm. I enjoy the camaraderie. Mm-hmm. I enjoy getting goals, setting goals and getting them done. It's rewarding when we can help, especially children victims, child victims. I just enjoy the work. I enjoy the interaction with people, and I enjoy the idea that just about every day is different.
Yeah, so I guess how do you think that people's perceptions of police officers and is different from what you've really experienced?
Well, I think a lot is formed from television.
Yeah.
A lot of it is formed in the media. For example, a police job in the Deep South or way up north might be different than exactly what's happening here. And now with the advent of social media, sometimes national stories regarding, let's say, police brutality or an unlawful arrest or lawsuits, it gets projected onto this small department, and it's not necessarily fair. Mm-hmm. Because I think that we don't have those issues here. Not that we shouldn't be aware of all these things, but to equate us with, let's say, a poorly managed or a poorly run police department is not fair to our guys. Because I think we have a really good group of men and women here, well-educated, mm-hmm. thoughtful, well-mannered. I'm always out there trying to get the truth out about the small department, is that they're really helpful, nice bunch of young people.
Yeah.
Great. So now transitioning to the bail part. For our listeners who didn't hear the show in November that we did with you, we discussed the recent bail law that we think went into effect in January of this year. Could you just give us like a little recap of the law, how it was then?
Sure. Well, what happened is the history of this thing, and a lot of the change was brought about because of some injustices. So what happens is up to this point, if someone committed a crime, you bring them in front of a judge. They can be arraigned, it's called, and they can be asked for cash bail. So a shoplifter could be asked for $100 bail. Otherwise, he's got to go to jail until his next court appearance. So what happened is a lot of people felt that was unfair. It was unfair to people that can't post the money, can't come up with the cash. So while a person of means could just pay the bail, the bond, and get out, so they saw an inequity there. Also, there were some injustices down, especially in Rikers Island, a big jail down in New York City, where they're overwhelmed with people in jail. They're at maximum capacity, and people's civil and human rights were being denied. The problem So then what happened is the legislature got together, the state legislature got together, and they basically eliminated cash bail for many, many, many crimes. Mm-hmm. And I think that they overstepped in this. I don't think that they did the right thing, because what they basically did was take the discretion of the judge away from them. And what I want to say is it's been conventional wisdom that a judge only puts bail on someone so that to make sure that they come back to court. But that's not true. A judge weighs all factors when they have someone that comes in front of them. So, in other words, they should weigh, is this guy a member of our community? Does he have a job? Has he been a risk before? Is there a substantial threat to the public? The judge should be able to weigh these things and then determine if there should be bail. And this new law kind of took that away. It took that ability away from the judges, and I just don't think it's right. Mm-hmm.
So I guess last time we discussed what some of the effects would be, and you said like there would be probably a lot of extra work for some of your officers, and also the fact that suspects would be allowed to visit the crime scenes might raise public concern. Have any of these issues arisen so far? I know we're only about a month or a month
right.
and a half in.
Yeah, that's a good question. We've been monitoring it. We've had a few instances where people have been arrested, mm-hmm. or we're dealing with an assault case right now, a very serious assault, where the person previously would have been in jail. Mm-hmm. So here in this little city, this little department, we've only had a couple instances. But if you read the articles, what's going on, let's say, in New York City, there have many, many instances where someone, you know, a member of the public was harmed with a person that otherwise would have been behind bars. Also, we're seeing crime rates go up in the city. I just think it's too early right now. I have an opinion. I just feel it's a little too early right now to project all these things after just about 5 weeks or six weeks.
Mm-hmm. So, as you said, it's a little early, but were there any effects that you see now that were unexpected, maybe? Or
I guess that you think that you might see in the future that you hadn't anticipated?
Miles, that's a good question. Remember from our discussion before, it's not only the bail reform, it's also the discovery reform, which is a fancy way of saying when we arrest somebody, we're on a much tighter timeline to get everything to the courts. So that to me has caused a lot of extra work for me and for my department. And I think who's been most vocal about it lately is the Troy Police Department up in Rensselaer County, where they say, hey, we've got our guys at the station processing all this paperwork while there's crime out in the streets that we're not able to respond to as quick as we'd like to. So this is an area that I think we really got to watch. If you know, how much paperwork is attached to a particular police arrest or investigation that might hurt public safety because our patrol won't be available. And that's something I'm going to have to monitor over this year. So the discovery rules accompanied with the bail reform is I'm not ready to, without facts, I'm not really ready to, but I have an opinion, and my opinion is they probably should really look at this law again.
Mm-hmm. So have there been any, do you know if there, I've seen some discussion of this in news, but do you know if there have been any proposed like official changes to this law, or
I've heard both things. You know, the legislature now, I guess there's been some on the state level some repairs proposed that are being considered now, mm-hmm. but there's also vocal people that are saying stay the course, stay with the bail reform, mm-hmm. so it's something they're going to have to hash out in the state legislature. Mm-hmm. Now, the sheriff's department up in Washington County has quite a big following. They started a campaign on Facebook and social media to get a group together to really try to bring about change on this bail reform. And I see that it's catching a lot of. They had a little protest up there at the mm-hmm. Capitol. So there's a lot of opinions on both sides here. But I think that the strongest voice right now is on the side that they need to really change this law.
Mm-hmm. Do you think they should repeal it altogether, or would that be, I guess, unfair to people who?
The standard answer is that we need some kind of bail reform.
Yeah.
That's been pretty much the boilerplate answer of all police officials across the state, because you don't want to see injustices, right? But they just don't feel that this was the correct measure.
Yeah,
and I think that's basically how I feel too.
Mm-hmm. They should keep this bail law in place, but make some modifications to make it
absolutely, mm-hmm. absolutely. I think judges need to judge. They need to look at things in a case by case basis. Because every case, I'd like to think, is different mm-hmm. and has a different set of circumstances with different victims and different defendants. And I think a judge, they're smart. Mm-hmm. They should be even have the opportunity to evaluate this and see what's the threat to our community.
Uh-huh. Do you think they should also factor in the fact that people might not be able to pay the bail who just don't have as much money as other people who could?
Or? I think it's a balancing act. You have to weigh a person's ability to pay bail against what will the threat to the community be if this person is released. Mm-hmm. And that's where the judges come in, and that's, I think, why we pay them to judge. Mm-hmm. And many of them are very good at figuring that out.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Congratulations to you guys. The school year is going right along.
Yeah.
And you're always welcome here. Anytime you want to come and revisit any of these issues, I'd be glad to talk to you about it.
Great. Thank you.
See you guys.
That was the Hudson Chief of Police, Ella Edward Moore, speaking to Miles and Rafi about the bail law.
Yesterday, all my troubles seemed so far away. Now it looks as though they're here to stay. Oh, I believe. Yesterday, suddenly, I'm not half the man I used to be. There's a shadow hanging over me. Oh, yesterday came suddenly. Why she had to go, I don't know, she wouldn't say. I said something wrong, now I long for yesterday. Love was such an easy game to play. I need a place to hide away. Oh, I believe in yesterday. Why she to go, I don't know, she wouldn't say. I said something wrong, now I long for yesterday. Love was such an easy game to play. I need a place to hide.